Hey, this is John at Bible Project. This year, we've been exploring the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. We're currently taking questions for our third question and response episode in this series. We'll be looking at questions from episode 15, which is the eye for eye passage, all the way up until the Lord's Prayer begins. So send us your questions by May 20th and send it to info@bibleproject.com. Let us know your name, where you're from, and try to keep your question to about 20 seconds or so. And if you can transcribe it when you email it in, that's a real big help for our team. We look forward to hearing from you. Now, here's the episode. This is John at the Bible Project, and today on the podcast, we continue our conversation on the law. In the modern world, we understand law as a set of legal requirements that society has for us. Things you can do, things you can't do. And if someone's behavior is in question, we go to the written law and we see what it says. It's the final authority. And we call this statutory law.
What we have to do is try to imagine a culture where things don't work like that. We have to imagine where people who live in a society have a set of views about a transcendent concept of justice and goodness and righteousness. But the written law codes are not the official statement. They are illustrations written in specific times and places, but no one written statement is the final arbiter or word. It's a statement that participates in a long history of statements.
This is really hard for us to appreciate, but imagine you live in a society where you have written laws, but you also have your culture's stories, you have the wisdom of the elders, and all of these things are consulted, but not as the final authority, but as a way to help you get to a deeper authority, that is, God's justice.
Law isn't the right word anymore. Yes, wisdom. Wisdom and the fear of the Lord, living in a way that corresponds to God's will.
And the law for ancient Israel wasn't simply a set of things to do and not do. It was a relational agreement about how to be in a covenant with God.
The laws are a relational authority for ancient Israel, and they were to be formed by that relationship and to take on the character traits of God's justice and generosity and character, so that other nations could look at ancient Israel and be like, whoa, that's a different way to be humans.
So today we discuss the difference between statutory law and what we'll call common law. It's a subtle difference, but it will help us appreciate how to read the laws in our Bible.
It was a paradigm shift that's been immensely helpful for me in understanding what the Torah is and the laws within it.
Thanks for joining us. Here we go. We are talking about laws, biblical laws, the law code.
Yes.
In the Bible.
In the first few books of the Bible.
Yeah.
Yep.
They're all in the first five books of the Bible.
Yeah. And actually, they're not in the first book, Genesis, in the second, third, fourth, and fifth.
Yeah.
Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy.
You'll find them dispersed throughout those books.
Yes. Over 600.
There's over 600.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we had a really great conversation on why do we have all of these laws?
Yeah.
And I think the takeaway was, well, we can know for sure that the reason wasn't to give a complete list of laws to live by.
Yeah, of God's will for human life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not designed that way.
Mm-mm.
If that was its purpose, it failed.
Right.
At that.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about problems in the law codes for readers, ancient and modern, why the same principle or law will be worded in different ways, mm-hmm. or sometimes contradictory ways.
Mm-hmm.
Do you boil the Passover lamb or do you roast it?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the Sabbath or do you keep the Sabbath? That's a smaller one.
But yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just interesting that why would, if you're going to repeat a law, why wouldn't you repeat it?
Correct.
With the exact same words.
Correct. Yeah.
It to be crystal clear.
Yeah.
And then we talked about this rabbinic tradition of both trying to distill all the laws into kind of this smaller set of axioms or values or whatever that helps you understand all of the laws. And then also the rabbinic tradition of taking a law that doesn't seem to explain enough of what you need, like the Sabbath,
then
expounding on it, creating more law.
Yeah.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here are a handful of perspectives. It'll probably take us a couple episodes to kind of talk through these. But I found these immensely helpful to just let each one of these, there's six individual perspectives, but they work together. And if I was going to try and recreate the journey I've been on over the last many years in understanding how laws work in the Bible, it's bound up in these six statements or perspectives.
These six perspectives helps you
understanding what the laws are, why they're in the Bible, and how I should relate to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep. There you go. Number one.
Number one.
We've already kind of established this, but we'll just make it clear. The laws, the 611 or 13 laws, are not a law code.
Yep.
They're not a code.
Meaning?
Meaning if we went down to the courthouse, the Portland courthouse.
Yeah.
Where you go to serve jury duty and all these things. So there are judges, and actually, I don't know if they're, maybe they might be housed in the state. There's a like a research library, a consulting library there where cases can be paused and judges and attorneys can like go consult the law. Most of it's being digitized. Actually, most of it's probably already been digitized.
Sure it is.
But in other words, the law code that governs our land is that actual body of written text that is somewhere that is to be consulted when judges are applying the law.
And you're saying that the laws in the Bible are not that.
Correct.
But they are written because they're written in the Bible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're definitely written. Totally.
They're written in a section of the Bible called the law.
They're written in a section of the Bible called Torah.
Torah.
In Hebrew.
Which you could translate as...
Which means instruction or teaching.
Teaching, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, importantly, there isn't a Hebrew word that quite precisely corresponds to our word law. The words in the Hebrew Bible are custom or practice, instruction or teaching, command. The closest would be statute, which means something inscribed. But even all those are different than our concept of law. I should probably work that out at some point. I haven't taken that one to the bottom yet. But the point is that whatever the first five books of the Bible are, they aren't an ancient version of what judges consult on the digitized law codes of the statutes of the state of Oregon or United States.
Now, arguably, did that exist?
I'm going to show you pictures of one. Well, actually, sorry. The simple answer to your question is no. Those didn't exist in the ancient world.
Yeah.
And for an important reason, because our concept of what a law code is in our day is fundamentally different than how they conceived of laws and codes in the ancient world. But we'll get there.
Okay.
So if the laws aren't a comprehensive code, what are they?
What are they?
Well, the narrative presents them as the terms of a covenant agreement between two parties, namely Yahweh and the people of Israel. In other words, the Torah is a narrative about God entering a formal relationship with a group of people.
Yeah.
And these laws in the narrative are the terms of their agreement.
Okay. Now, it just feels like this is semantics now at this point, because the terms of an agreement that have consequences.
Yeah, we don't call that law in English.
Yeah, we would.
Really?
What would you call that?
If you and I formed...
Oh, okay.
Let's say you and I started a nonprofit together.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'll stretch my imagination.
But let's say we wanted to formalize... it doesn't work for a nonprofit. Let's say we started a for-profit.
Okay.
And we wanted to formalize whatever, how our relationship works and who does what and whatever.
And we're going to agree on it.
Yeah, we might call them stipulations.
Yeah, what do you call those? Well, I mean, we were just looking at these the other day during a board meeting. What do they call them?
We call them bylaws,
yeah.
Which is how the Bible Project board the rules of operation.
Yeah.
So if we have a whole society of people and we're agreeing, this is how we're going to live together.
Yeah.
That's the only agreement is we're going to live together here in a way that's hopefully peaceable. And so we call those rules law, commonly in English. That's the law. But if two parties intentionally form a relationship to accomplish a goal together,
yeah,
we wouldn't normally call the terms of the relationship laws.
Yeah.
We would call them
bylaws.
Terms, we would call them stipulations. We call them bylaws?
Well, yeah, look at this. I just Googled it. The main difference between a bylaw and a law is the law is passed by a national, federal, or regional state body.
Mm-hmm.
Bylaw is made by a non-sovereign body.
Uh-huh.
And it derives its authority from another governing body. Oh, I see. So if we were just kind of like, we're going on a hike and we're going to be on this hike for 7 days. Let's create some rules.
Rules of the road.
Rules of the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's agree on like what our relationship's going to be like for these 7 days.
Yeah, that's right.
You wouldn't call those bylaws because we're not adhering to.
Yeah, correct.
We're not being governed by.
Correct. And we could write them out and sign on them. This is very common. Very common.
In hiking?
No, just in like day-to-day life.
Yeah.
Two neighbors
want
to overlap their property to make a common deck or something.
Okay. Yeah.
And so write it up. I had to buy a used car recently.
Yeah.
And so they did a couple repairs. We had to write up a terms of them guaranteeing
now
those repairs.
And all these terms derive their authority from another group.
But the authority, I guess the authority in a covenant relationship is...
Is the relationship.
Is the relationship itself.
Yeah, not some bigger...
And usually the... Yeah, exactly.
That's the difference.
That's the difference.
What's the authority?
Correct.
Is the authority some governing sovereign body, meaning a group of people
who
all say that they exist as some state or
that's
nation?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or is the authority just merely... But that is a type of relationship.
No, of course it is. I guess here's the difference. I live in the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
There is a number of governing bodies that have determined what are the laws of the land that I try my best to abide by.
Yeah. There's the city of Portland. There's Multnomah County.
Totally.
There's the state of Oregon.
That's right.
And then there's the federal
government.
And
if I go to whatever, the state capitol or the courthouse in Portland or log in online, I could find... That law, those lists of statutes written that have been authorized.
And that's a law code.
It's a law code.
Okay.
When I open up the first five books of the Bible, I am not reading a law code.
Yeah.
I'm reading a narrative about one party in the ancient world, the people of ancient Israel, entering into a covenant relationship with the deity.
And the laws are illustrating
the terms of the agreement between these two parties that I'm not one of.
Yeah.
I wasn't at Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
It's a narrative about a covenant relationship. That's what the Torah is. It's a narrative about a covenant relationship. And that narrative is very instructive for me. That's what the word Torah means, instruction.
Yeah.
It's a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
The laws are not a law code.
Right.
The Torah is not a law code.
Got it.
For all people of all time. It's a narrative about a covenant relationship between Yahweh and Israel, and the laws, there's a lot of them, but they're not comprehensive. They're selected to match the numerical value of the word Torah, and they illustrate the nature of their covenant relationship. That's the first key paradigm shift I invite people into.
So for me, okay, I just want to make sure I understand this paradigm shift. In the same way, if we were to write a story... About how all the Oregon laws came to be, or kind of the big grand, why does Oregon exist and why are these laws? We would tell the story. We would then pull from the law code, specific laws that would help us understand the story. And if we wanted that to be instructive for the now, what does it mean to be an Oregonian? Then we have something more similar.
Yeah, that's right.
To the Torah.
Correct. Yeah.
It's not the law code.
Yeah. Yep. Correct. The law code existed and exists somewhere else for some other purpose. This is a narrative. I liked your hiking example, actually. If you and I went backpacking and we wrote up a two-page agreement about who gets the water at the end of the day, who cleans the dishes after dinner,
yeah.
who cleans
how
up.
How many miles we'll hike in a day.
How many miles we hike in a day. All right, we write it all up because yeah. we've learned that we're like, whatever, super contentious and like have to make this clear. And then, let's say we both live in the state of Oregon. And so we are inspired by some of the laws of the land. Like, oh, you know, one of the laws in Oregon is people do this, people don't do that. And so we use wording and concepts from our state law code, and we borrow them and adapt them in our little formal agreement between us.
Oh, okay.
And then if one of us was to, years later, write a narrative about our hike and include large selections of our formal agreement in the narrative itself, that would be more like what the Torah is.
So you're saying that the original set of terms of this covenant, even itself, isn't a law code.
Ah, well, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
How law worked in the ancient world and what law codes were is different, totally different than our culture. My point here is just, what is the Torah, the five books of the Bible in front of us?
Yeah.
They are a narrative about a covenant relationship.
Yeah.
They're not a law code.
They're a narrative about a covenant relationship.
Yes.
The covenant relationship had terms.
Correct.
Those terms we call laws.
Common English. Yeah. Or bylaws.
Well, I'm just saying when we talk about this whole series is how to read the law.
Oh, I understand. Yes. Yeah. So got
that's
it.
The word we use.
Yeah.
Should we stop calling it that?
Well, no. We should just use the word law.
Okay.
But it's covenant law.
It's covenant law.
Yeah.
It's not law code in the way that we understand
That's right.
law code.
So after I use the word law the first time, I just swap it out for the word terms, covenant terms.
Covenant. So covenant law. And covenant law is different than law code.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what the main difference, what I heard you say, is that it's based on a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Both parties take it upon themselves to operate by these terms for the sake of this relationship.
And I'm just going to be a jerk for a second and just say, isn't that what all law is?
Yes, in a way.
Okay.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, we agree to live in the city of Portland. We will live by these laws. But a covenant relationship is specific, and you know, it's our covenant video. It's a partnership to accomplish something, a particular thing together.
Yeah.
Here in Portland, it's accomplishing what? The well-being? I don't know. My main purpose is to simply say the literary form of the first five books of the Bible isn't a law code.
Yeah, I get that.
It's a narrative about a covenant, and the laws illustrate the terms of that covenant relationship.
Now, I guess maybe this is where I'm getting hung up. It's not a law code. It's a narrative about a covenant. Another way to say that is it's not a law code. It's a narrative about a law code based on a covenant.
It's a narrative about a covenant that has drawn upon an ancient law code that is not contained within the Bible itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
There have to have been more rules governing the life of ancient Israel.
Yeah.
What we have are 611.
I just hear you trying to make a difference between covenant terms.
Covenant terms.
And law code.
Okay, got it.
In my mind, they get too blurred too quickly.
You're right. What you're saying is they're two subsets within the same type of group.
Yeah, which is the bigger group is...
just rules for governing common life together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in that sense, granted. totally granted. You're right. So what you're asking is helping me clarify what my main point is and is not. There are laws within the covenant terms in the Torah that are verbatim from other ancient Near Eastern law codes.
Oh.
So what that tells us is the way that through Moses and then the prophets and scribes who shaped the Torah after him, the way they conceived of God wanting them to live fit within the ancient cultural context.
Interesting.
But also adapted it in an important way. That's a later perspective. So, okay, first point.
Not a law code.
This is the narrative design shape of the covenant-making ceremony in the book of Exodus. So when they leave Egypt and they go to the foot of Mount Sinai, that's Exodus 19. Exodus 19 through 24 is where the Ten Commandments appear, and it's where they sign on the dotted line to enter the covenant. The narrative of six chapters are designed in this real precise symmetry. On the outer frame is chapters 19 and 24. There's all this verbatim language, but In chapter 19, they approach the mountain. Mm-hmm. Moses goes up, and he invites all Israel to listen to my voice and keep my covenant. Mm. That's the opening lines. Mm. Listen to my voice, which is the Hebrew word for obey.
Yeah.
There's no word for obey.
It's just listen.
To listen. So listen to my voice and keep my covenant. And Israel says, all that Yahweh has spoken, we're going to do. And Yahweh comes down and he reveals.
This is the I do in a marriage ceremony.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then the next thing is the cloud and fire comes down the mountain and God speaks the Ten Commandments. Then you get a little narrative at the center of this whole section about how the people don't want to go up the mountain. Mm-hmm. They say, we're going to die if we go close to God.
Yeah.
So Moses, you go up for us.
Yeah.
He goes up on their behalf. And
that's right in the center of this.
That's right in the center. And then you get the next body of covenant laws, 42, the 42 laws. Mm-hmm. In both the Ten Commandments and in those 42 laws, mm-hmm. the first command is,
don't make any other gods.
Don't have any other gods and don't make any idols.
Yeah.
Moses comes down after getting the 42 laws and it's the same divine appearance of cloud and fire. Moses writes the scroll of the covenant. The people say the same thing they said in chapter 19, all that Yahweh has spoken, we will do.
Yeah.
So this is the first revelation of law in the story.
Mm. Yeah.
It's the Ten Commandments and the laws, and it's sandwiched in between in 19 and 24, mm-hmm. a covenant actual ceremony.
Mm. Yeah.
So my point here is just that even the first time laws are introduced in the narrative, it's in a marriage ceremony.
Yeah.
Between Yahweh and Israel.
Yeah.
So that tells you the purpose of the laws.
Yeah.
They illustrate the terms of the covenant relationship.
Yeah.
If Israel obeys these terms, the opening prologue to the covenant in Exodus 19, we've talked about this before. This is where we get the phrase kingdom of priests. Mm-hmm. So if you, this is Exodus chapter 19, verses 4 through 6, if you listen to my voice and keep my covenant, then result, if you listen and obey.
Yeah.
It's a condition.
Yeah.
If you listen and obey, then you'll be my own possession among all the peoples. Because listen, all the earth is mine. So I could choose a lot of different people here, you guys.
Yeah.
I chose one people.
Yeah.
But you're only going to fulfill your purpose
if
you obey the covenant.
Yeah.
If you do, then you'll be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. We made a whole video about this in the law video. The kingdom of priests is about being sacred representatives to the nations. Mm-hmm. So there you go. The laws are relational authority for ancient Israel. And they were to be formed by that relationship and to take on the character traits of God's justice and generosity and character so that other nations could look at ancient Israel and be like, whoa, that's a different way to be humans.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's the idea.
Now, that's the purpose of the terms of the covenant, which is synonymous with law code in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Or with law. So to go back to this American thing, like life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, all of our laws are for that purpose. So for Israel, it's to be a kingdom of priests.
Yes, yeah.
To then show the world the nature of God.
Yep.
And I mean, this whole recreation of the world.
Yes.
For America, it's, hey, let's have life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of a parallel there, but what we don't get in the Torah is then the whole list.
Correct, yeah.
We get
a sampler.
We get the sampler.
Yeah.
And it's couched in the narrative.
Yeah, that's right.
Of how it came to be and the significance of it.
That's correct.
And we actually watch the ceremony.
Yeah, you watch the wet, yeah, totally.
And then you get to hear some of them.
Correct.
And then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's the feel. And of course, a lot of the rationale for the selection of the laws, like in both those cases, the Ten Commandments and the covenant laws both begin with the first command as don't have any other gods and don't make idols.
Yeah.
The first narrative after this mm-hmm. wedding ceremony is the story of the golden calf.
Yeah, right.
So
they're designing it
mm-hmm.
so that you can see
yeah.
that the law isn't going to be upheld.
Correct. So in other words, this is going to be a later perspective that we'll get to. But this narrative about you and me going on a hiking trip and agreeing to the terms of our relationship
yeah.
and including even specific of the rules in the narrative that we've agreed to. To imitate the Torah, our narrative would then have to go on and tell story after story of how you and I violate the agreement.
The story would be like, so Tim and John, they wrote out a list, and the first thing on the list yeah. was, don't wake each other up until 8 a.m.
Yeah, that's right.
In the first morning
yeah.
of the trip, John got up at 6:30 and started
yeah.
just singing and
yeah.
clanging pots.
Pelting Tim with pine cones.
yeah.
Yeah, that's what the narrative would be like. In which case, again, you have to back up and you say, what's the purpose of this narrative?
Yeah.
Is this narrative trying to tell me that I'm supposed to obey all these laws?
And if I'm going to go on a hike with my friends,
mm-hmm.
yeah, am I going to then go and just mine all the laws?
Yeah.
And then now
yeah.
those are our
yeah.
hiking rules?
Yeah. So yeah. So at that point, I just want to say, let's just stop and be patient. Let's let the story tell itself.
Okay.
Let's try and understand how laws worked in the ancient world, how laws work in this narrative, and then clarity emerges.
Yeah.
But that's the first paradigm shift, terms of the covenant.
Yeah.
It's not a law code, it's the terms of the covenant. Another helpful way to see how the Torah is not an ancient law code
mm-hmm.
is to compare it to actual ancient law codes.
Okay. Yeah.
Like we have them. They've been discovered. And so this is wonderful because it's like, oh, not only is the Torah not a law code, it's a narrative about a covenant, but if we wanted to see what an ancient law code looked like to compare yeah. it to the Torah, we have them.
Hmm.
And there's the most famous one. Actually, I don't know how famous it is anymore.
Hmm.
It's called the Code of Hammurabi.
Yeah. I only know of it because we've talked about it.
Oh, really?
Well.
Never heard of it before?
I may have, but I never really became in any way familiar with it until we started talking about it.
All right. Well, there you go. Let's talk about the Code of Hammurabi.
Hammurabi.
So in 1901, there was an Egyptologist, an expert in ancient Egypt, named Gustave Yekier. He's French, and he found this huge basalt stone pillar in Susa of what was then called Khuzestan, which ancient Khuzestan is in modern-day Iran, southern part of modern-day Iran. So this is massive stone. It's like over 6 feet tall.
Okay.
It's big. And if you look, the length of the pillar is mostly just written in this ancient cuneiform script. But at the top of it is a picture, and it's a picture of a king, Hammurabi, on the left. He's standing,
yeah,
and he is approaching the throne of a seated royal figure who's a god, a deity.
Mm.
And actually, just notice, this is related to our other conversations about spiritual beings, but notice that the deity, whose name is Shamash, which is the word sun.
Mm. Oh, like the S-U-N.
S-U-N, the sun. So he is the sun.
He's the sun god.
He's the sun god. Notice that seated, Shamash, the sun god, is as tall as Hammurabi is standing.
Mm.
He's a giant.
He's a big dude. He's a giant.
He's a giant.
Oh, yeah.
Deities are giants.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's what Shamash, he's handing to Hammurabi. He has a ring and a staff. He has fire leaping off of his shoulders. That's how you know he's Shamash, the sun god.
Oh, yeah.
And he's handing to Hammurabi a ring and a staff, which are symbols of divine royal authority.
Mm. Wow.
So it's a picture of, imagine this is propaganda you put of yourself if you're a king.
I got this stuff from
the I've been sun commissioned god. By the gods to rule the world.
Here's an image of it.
Here's an image.
Happened.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Yeah. Look, it's proof. And so here's the prologue. Here's like the first words. When lofty Anum, king of the Anunnaki, and Enlil, lord of heaven and earth, the determiner of destinies of the land. They determined for Marduk, the firstborn of Enki. These are all gods, different coalitions of gods. Mm-hmm. He made a great kingdom. He made Marduk great, and he called Babylon the kingdom's name. So in other words, this it begins with a story about how Babylon, the kingdom over which I reign, is established by the most powerful gods out there.
So this law code starts with a narrative too.
This law code starts with a narrative about how the gods founded our kingdom. Mm-hmm. Yep. He made Babylon supreme in the world, established for him in its midst an enduring kingship whose foundations are as firm as heaven and earth. That's handy. When the gods start a kingdom, they appoint a human king. And at that time, Anum and Enlil, who established Babylon and the kingship, they named me to promote the welfare of the people, me, Hammurabi the devout, the God-fearing prince, to cause justice to prevail in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evil, that the strong might not oppress the weak, to rise like the sun over humankind. Stop. These are the words right below a picture
of the sun god.
Of Hammurabi being commissioned by the sun. But now Hammurabi himself is to be the sun rising over the land. Mm-hmm. Think of Genesis 1 in terms of the sun, moon, and stars rule over the day and night, and then humans rule over the land.
Yeah.
The suns are a sign of God's power. The humans are an image of God. We're in the same thought world here.
Yeah, but in the Hammurabi's law code, the sun is the god, not a sign.
Yeah, that's
to the
right.
God.
Yeah, and here the sun is a deity. The sun is the deity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In Genesis 1, the sun, moon, and stars are created beings who are images of God's glory.
Yeah.
And so are humans. Here, the sun is the ultimate god.
Yeah.
And he only appoints one human.
Mm.
In Genesis 1, all humans are the image of the divine ruling.
Yeah, right.
Here, there's one deity, the sun, appointing one human, the king, to light up the land. Hammurabi, the shepherd, called by Enlil, the one who makes affluence and plenty abound.
Yeah.
The one, and this is important, the one who relayed the foundations of Sippar, the ancient temple city, who decked with green the chapels of Aya, the designer of the temple of Ababar, which is like a heavenly dwelling. So the gods have appointed me.
And I created the temple.
And the first thing I did was rebuild the ancient temple city and build the temple itself. And by the way, the temple here on earth is like the heavens.
Yeah.
He makes the temple an image or a mirror of the heavenly temple of the gods.
Same thought world.
Totally.
Of the biblical authors.
Yeah, totally. So then what he says is, this is top of the next page, is when the god Marduk commanded me to provide just ways for the people of the land, appropriate behavior, I established truth and justice, I enhanced the well-being of the people, and then what begins is a list of 282 laws. And these laws read a lot like the laws of the Torah. Here, I'll just let you read a couple.
Number 196, if a man destroy the eye of another man, they shall destroy his eye. If one breaks a man's bone, they shall break his bone. If one destroys the eye of a free man or break the bone of a free man, he shall pay one gold mina. Mina? Mina? If one destroys the eye of a man's slave or breaks a bone of the man's slave, he shall pay one half of his price.
Yeah. Okay, so let's pause.
Yeah.
Eye for eye.
Yeah.
Right?
There's a very similar law in the Torah.
Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, wound for wound.
There's a price in the Torah too, isn't there?
Totally, yeah. It's called damages, where if you injure somebody and they're laid up for a while and can't work, you pay them damages. If you injure somebody's slave, that kind of thing. Yeah, totally. Yep.
Number 250.
Yes.
If an ox gores to death a man while it's passing through the street, that case has no basis for a claim.
Yeah.
Sorry, dude.
So if you're ox.
It's an ox. Stay out of its way.
Yeah, totally. But next one.
Oh, 251. If a man's ox is a known gorer.
Yeah. If it did a second time or a third time,
Okay. And the authorities of the city quarter notify him that it's a known gorer. And he's not blunted.
Yeah, he doesn't. He hasn't shaved off the horns.
Yeah. And that ox gores to death a member of the,
a Wheelu class.
A Wheelu class.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. I'm going to look them up. The Wheelu class.
Then the owner shall give 30 shekels of silver. That's how much a person's life is worth. It's great. I mean, it's very practical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it totally is.
What's the Wheelu class?
It just says a person of standing. I think it means a citizen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So again, the reason here is there's a whole section of laws in the covenant code in Exodus that we just read.
Yeah, goring.
About the goring ox.
Ox.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Which apparently, I mean, in farming communities, of course.
Yeah, you're going to have ox cruising around.
Totally, yeah.
It's a common problem.
Yeah, it'll spear you through.
Yeah.
And so if it's just a one-off, you know, then sorry that happened to you. But if it happens a second, third time, then you
the ox is a problem.
Yeah, totally. So it's just a sampling, but these are three good examples that show like, yeah, these are formed in exactly the same vocabulary as the laws of the Bible.
Yeah.
Okay, you finish the 282 laws and here's the epilogue.
Okay.
May any king who appears in the land in the future at any time observe the pronouncements of justice I've inscribed upon this statue. May he not alter the judgments I've rendered or the verdicts I gave, nor removed my engraved image. If any man has discernment and is capable of providing just ways for his land, may he heed the pronouncements I've inscribed upon the statue. So here's a law code.
Yeah.
It looks like a law code.
Yeah.
It presents itself. There is a little narrative.
Yeah.
But it's a foundation narrative to tell you
why this is important.
Why this, you're hearing the word of the gods. Mm. And then it presents the list, and then it ends with a little warning to any leader after me should do this.
And was this supposed to be an exhaustive list then? Like,
We'll talk about that. But let's just, here's what an ancient code looks like.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
This is not the Torah.
Okay. Right, yeah.
The Torah doesn't look like this.
Yeah.
What it looks like is that the Torah is a narrative about an ancient covenant, and that the authors of the Torah have selected certain laws out of a pre-existing kind of law code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know if there was ever some sort of statue with laws on it or written of some sort of exhaustive thing like this.
Okay, this is interesting. After Moses is about to die and he commissions Joshua, he says, when you go into the land, after you make your first settlement, find a huge rock and
make a pillar,
cover it with plaster, and then etch into it the words of the Torah.
Huh.
So he tells him. And then there's a narrative in Joshua about Joshua doing this.
Huh.
So the question is, what did he write? He almost certainly didn't write the whole Pentateuch.
Yeah.
Genesis through Deuteronomy.
Right.
So what he's writing is some ancient version of the laws of the covenant.
Yeah.
That you could write on a standing stone.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't know what that is or have record of it.
Mm.
So there was something.
There was something
out there that was drawn upon. Mm. But the point is the Torah is a sampler of something that preexisted. And if we want to know what kind of thing might have preexisted, here's the Code of Hammurabi. It's a wonderful example.
Yeah, not only is it an example, but some of the laws, like those three we read, are very similar.
Very similar to laws found in Israel's laws.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's some puzzles about the law code. This is an episode about the Code of Hammurabi. Mm-hmm. But these problems with the code are helpful, I think, for coming back to the laws of the Torah.
Yeah.
This is from a scholar named Joshua Berman, who's, I'm going to be quoting his work quite a lot later on. He says, this code is one of the most frequently copied texts from the ancient world.
Hmm.
Over a course of 1,500 years, the Code of Hammurabi was adopted by other kings, recopied, new statues.
Hmm.
I mean, this went viral in the ancient world.
Yeah. Ancient viral law code.
So we have dozens of copies from all throughout the ancient world of the Code of Hammurabi.
Mm-hmm.
We also, in ancient Babylon, the Hittite kingdom, ancient Canaan, we have thousands of legal documents that have been discovered, land agreements, purchase agreements, divorce certificates.
Mm.
So Joshua Berman goes on. He says, of the thousands of Mesopotamian legal documents in our possession, not one of them quotes from the Code of Hammurabi or any other code as a source of authority. This is in spite of the fact that the Code of Hammurabi was esteemed and recopied for more than a millennium. All of this suggests that ancient Near Eastern law codes were of a literary or educational or monumental nature rather than legal and judicial. In other words, whatever law codes were in the ancient world, they existed. Code of Hammurabi is one of them.
Yeah.
What was their purpose or function? Did they exist so that judges who are trying cases could go look at the pillar and be like, what should I do here? Law 253 says this, and now I will apply that principle. That's how law works in our culture.
Yeah.
Law codes.
Yep.
That's how it works.
Yep.
So he's just noticing, it's just interesting. We have thousands of legal records from the ancient world. Never once is any ancient law code quoted as a source of authority for the decision being made in these thousands of cases. That's interesting. What's also interesting is that in those legal documents, some of them are like a civil dispute about somebody hit another person or somebody. Some of them are about situations that are addressed in the law code.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be decisions that were made that explicitly contradict or the money. Remember the thing of in the Code of Hammurabi was if somebody hits somebody's slave, they have to pay this certain amount, one gold mina.
Mm-hmm.
But then there'll be a document about a case where somebody did this and they'll get fined 15 gold minas or something.
Yeah.
So not only are these codes never quoted in actual law cases.
They're not even adhered to.
There are decisions being made in law cases in Babylon that don't follow the code.
So if they didn't use the code as the authority,
yes,
what was the authority?
Exactly. That's the problem I'm trying to expose here.
Yeah.
The rabbit hole goes a little deeper.
Okay.
If you're interested.
Yeah.
If I have your curiosity piqued.
It did.
So here, it's at this point that scholars of ancient law have had to go through a paradigm shift that's still happening. I think it began in kind of the 1980s.
Scholars of ancient law.
Oh, totally.
It's a very niche field.
Yeah, it's totally a niche field. But these groups of people exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. So one of the godfather figures is named Raymond Westbrook. But essentially what we're up against here is that not all cultures have the same uses of law codes.
Okay,
different cultures do different things with law codes. Okay. So this is from a scholar of this niche topic named Michael Lefebvre, who wrote a comprehensive history of how Israelites and Jews perceived the laws in the Torah throughout their whole history.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a fascinating book. But he tries to help us see the difference between what he calls a legislative society.
Okay.
And what he calls a non-legislative society. You could also call it statutory law society, and then a common law or custom law society.
Okay.
And the difference is actually really simple. In a statutory or legislative society, the law of the land is an actual written text that has been authorized by a body of people.
Yeah.
And both all the people in that land and the judges of that land, their obligation is to the written text of the law.
Yeah. And the written text is the authority.
Correct. And what the written text is an embodiment of some transcendent set of values of justice that we all adhere to. And this written text is the way we're going to embody it here.
Yeah.
That's how most modern, at least democracies, work. There's a written text. Begins with the Constitution and all the way down.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is try to imagine a culture where things don't work like that. We have to imagine where people who live in a society have a set of views about a transcendence concept of justice and goodness and righteousness.
Yeah.
But the written law codes are not the official statement. They are illustrations written in specific times and places, but no one written statement is the final arbiter or word. Hmm. It's a statement that participates in a long history of statements. There you go. That's the basic point. Therefore, in a common law society where the written law codes are illustrations of our actual values of justice, the law codes have all kinds of purposes, like Hammurabi's is a great example.
Okay.
It's royal. What that is royal propaganda.
Right, yeah.
For how the gods authorized me.
Yeah.
And here is a, they're almost like a statement of the values of my...
platform?
Your platform, yeah, totally. It's like a statement of Hammurabi's platform.
Yeah.
But another king...
And so in that, he's making a case for his authority and his platform and how society exists under him.
Correct.
But then he gets very specific about like
super
goring
specific.
Oxes.
Yeah, totally.
Are you saying then that the specificity isn't to say this is how it will always be? The specificity is here's just an example.
Here's an example
of how this would come to play out.
Correct. And we know that ancient leaders of Babylon saw the Code of Hammurabi as an example because they didn't follow it.
But they still would follow the platform.
They would follow the principles.
The principles of the platform.
Correct. But when it comes to actual detailed applications, they're not following the numbers, the specific amount, monetary amounts for the fines. And they're not even appealing to the code itself because their obligation isn't to the Code of Hammurabi. Their obligation is to Shamash, the sun god.
It just seems chaotic to me.
Ah.
Right?
All right. That's how it appears to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
then, like, I'm just some dude in some city run by Babylon or some, like, village or whatever.
Yeah.
Something gets brought to me because I'm, whatever, respected or have some authority. And I'm just like,
yeah. Yeah.
15 minas. You 30.
Yeah.
And then it's like, what? It's like, the code says one. No, we're not even going to refer to the code. Who cares what the code says?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it becomes more fluid.
More fluid.
The law becomes fluid in its application. How else do you explain Moses telling one generation, roast the Passover lamb, and then the next generation, boil the Passover lamb?
Yeah, it's fluid.
It's fluid.
Yeah.
Okay. So
it's funny, it both makes sense. This distinction really helps, but then also makes me feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think it makes people who live in statutory law societies, it's a foreign way of conceiving of law and order.
Yeah.
It is a form of law and order. It's just a different form of law and order than we're used to.
Right.
Here's the thing, though. So again, this is the scholar Joshua Berman. He wrote two books that have been immensely helpful to me. One is called Created Equal. I think it's how the Bible broke with ancient political thought. And what he's showing, primarily that book is reading the ancient law code, the laws of the Torah, in relationship to their matching commands and other law codes.
Right.
And he just shows how the social order being envisioned by the laws of the Torah was both recognizable to ancient Babylonians and Canaanites, but a total ethical revolution towards a greater form of what we would call social equality between citizens.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
And sexes, genders.
And a lot of, well, not so much on the gender front.
Oh, no.
His argument is actually being a woman or a slave in ancient Israel, you were better off than you were in Babylon.
Yes.
But you weren't...
He wasn't completely equal.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about this a little bit more. The other book he wrote is called Inconsistency in the Torah. Because these discrepancies between different laws within the Torah itself have been used to build whole models of critical views of how the Pentateuch came into existence. How the different law codes were produced by completely different groups who were at odds with each other. And so what the Torah is a collection of actually competing, what were competing law codes by different groups in ancient Israel have been combined into one. This is a view that's out there. And what he's saying is that's imposing a completely modern
our perspective of
concept
law code.
Of a law code onto this ancient law code.
Yeah.
Ancient law codes were fluid expressions of common law. which meant the same code can have what we perceive as a contradiction. Mm. But they didn't view it that way, because law could be applied in different ways in different circumstances. Here's two illustrations that were helpful for me. So I didn't know this. This is like Joshua Berman gave me an education in like the history of law in Europe. Statutory law, where the law code is the authority.
Yeah.
It's a relatively modern invention in the history of the human race.
Yeah, I believe it.
Specifically in the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe.
Because you need kind of mass printing in order for it to really work.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, it's this, is that common law, where we all just kind of have a set of agreements.
Yeah.
They don't have to be written.
Yeah.
We can write expressions of them, but no written expression is the authority.
Right.
He says that kind of, that law can work in smaller, homogeneous societies, where everybody's kind of the same, and we all have a really tight social web and have the same religious and ethical values. It's the perfect system.
And also, it's a necessary system when not everyone can read.
Yep.
Yeah. There's not a really good way to pass around written. Like, the technology just doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's right.
Of, like, mass production.
Yeah, where's the written code and who can read it?
Yeah. And so it becomes a more necessary way of...
Correct.
...of thinking about...
Yeah, law. That's right. Yeah. So he's... Berman quotes from scholars who say, if you just trace the history of Europe, the rise of urbanization, the rise of immigration to large cities, more diverse populations in cities that have different value systems... And then the rise of the modern nation state, which redefined identity, not by ethnicity necessarily, but by land borders. The people who live in this land
and that's a,
are now...
That's a modern phenomenon.
Totally. The modern nation state. So he said the modern nation state is actually, and urbanization is the really key in the history of statutory law.
And then the technology of...
And technology of writing.
Writing.
Post-printing press.
Yeah.
So now you have different people who have different value sets living in the same city, but we are citizens together.
Yeah.
And so the rise of statutory law is that here's the law code, and doesn't matter who you are, we do this law according to this law code.
Yeah.
That's the basic idea.
It's interesting. When you give the history lesson,
it makes
a lot of sense, and my discomfort goes away a little bit because it just feels like necessary.
Yes.
Like this is how you would have had to do law.
Correct.
And then I think about judicial law and I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, that is just a modern phenomena.
Correct.
But now I'm importing back on the Bible.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
It's really
I had the same experience. It was just like, oh, wow. It's like somebody exposing that you're in a fish tank, but you didn't know it. Swimming in a fish tank, you know? Like you're a fish and you don't know that you're in it. You can't see the glass around you. And then someone points it out. And you're like, oh.
That's why my nose is all raw.
Totally. Okay. So this is fascinating. This is on the middle of page 11. This is a helpful illustration. So the point is common law societies flourished for most of human history.
Yeah.
Because they require smaller, pretty homogenous cultures where the common values are just assumed. You're raised into the value set.
Yeah.
By your parents and your community and your uncle. So in Germany in the 1800s, there was, I guess he was a professor of law and like the godfather. His name was Karl von Sovnye. He called this common value set, the Volksgeist, the spirit of the people or the collective consciousness of the people. So a common law where no written code is the official statement. The official statement is Volksgeist, right?
Yeah.
And so if you have a situation where social cohesion starts breaking down, it becomes more difficult for the law to be just what we all know is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So this is so interesting. One of Karl Sovnye's most famous students was Jacob Grimm of the Brothers Grimm.
Oh, yeah.
And he had his brother was Wilhelm. The Brothers yeah. Grimm.
The Brothers Grimm.
Yeah,
with all totally. The fables.
Yeah, totally. So Jacob Grimm mm-hmm. of the Brothers Grimm was one of the most famous lawyers and scholars of German law in Germany in the early 1800s. Their whole project
of
collecting the folklore and the stories of their people
wasn't
just to like create children's books.
Yeah.
It was a project aimed at upholding the common law tradition.
Yeah. They were collecting the, what was it?
The Volksgeist.
The Volksgeist.
The Volksgeist. So think of all these stories. Cinderella, Hansel and Gretel, Rapunzel,
yeah.
Rumpelstiltskin, Sleeping Beauty,
yeah.
The Frog Prince.
Yeah.
So what they developed was a scholarly set of tools for unearthing the original form of these stories and also how they changed through time and then creating the official written editions of them. But why? Why'd they put in all this work? They were trying to create the educational value code of German society in the 1800s, which begins with raising your kids. I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
What stories do we use to teach our kids what is right?
Yeah. How do we create in our kids the right sense of what it means to be a German?
Yep, yeah.
And
how we treat each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the early, I think it was 1812 through 1815, they created a big multi-volume edition of all the fairy tales. Folk tales.
Yeah.
Some of them are fairy tales, folk tales. Okay, this is fascinating. Maybe this isn't fascinating. I found this really fascinating. again, this is Joshua Berman. So he says, Jacob Grimm, the foremost student of Carl von Savigny, who was the founder of the historical school of German law studies. He believed that law must emanate from the mores, the social values of the people. And he initiated a vast effort to recover text and traditions that reflect the values and principles of German culture. The Grimm brothers' interest in German folklore stemmed from a conviction that those specimens of culture, these folk tales, contain the remnants of German law and liberties. Judges should adjudicate, make decisions, on the basis of a range of customary law sources. What do judges draw upon when they make a decision? Not a law code. They could use a law code as an illustration, but also including proverbs, mythology, folklore, poetry, and the like. This is fascinating. Jacob Grimm actually derived property laws from some of the folk tales found in their collection.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. So, I mean, it seems like what's happening is this is an example of this time in human history where we're moving from common law to
statutory
judicial law.
Yeah.
And the brothers Grimm are saying, hey, let's make this a really great transition.
Yes.
Let's take all
we've
discovered from all of these years of customary law.
Yeah.
And let's make sure that as we're making all this judicial law, that it's informed by it.
Yeah.
And so they are unearthing all of these fables.
Correct.
Which were what were used to help make
the
common law decisions.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Again, and this is helpful also to talk about the Pentateuch, the whole Pentateuch, the narratives and the laws as Torah instruction. In the same way that the Brothers Grimm viewed these folk tales
as instruction,
as a kind of legal education.
Yeah, right.
And so all of a sudden, what we call narrative and poetry and law, for them, those are literary distinctions.
Yeah.
But they're all aimed at
instruction,
instructing you in
what does it mean to be a German citizen?
Yeah. Yeah. And the Pentateuch pops into new perspective all of a sudden. Like the fact that it's narrative and poetry and law all in one book, but it's all aimed at instructing you in discerning God's will.
To be made in the image of God.
Yeah.
And to be in the family of Abraham.
Correct. Yeah.
I think I feel the discomfort of many people when we compare the Torah to fables.
Oh. Oh, got it. This is just an analogy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not making that kind of comparison.
Right.
I'm just saying for people in Jacob Grimm's time, where do you go to gain instruction in the ways of our people?
Yeah, it's not a set of statutory laws.
Yeah, you can consult a law code. That might be one illustration. But you also go to our foundation stories.
Yeah.
You go to the stories we tell our children and raise them on. You
right.
go to poetry.
Yeah.
These can all become examples of the Volksgeist.
The Volksgeist. That's a great word.
And so in the same way, the Pentateuch as a whole, not just the laws, but the whole, the narrative about the laws, everything is a part of instructing you in the Volksgeist of the kingdom of priests. That's the analogy I'm making.
And even though we live in a time in human history where judicial law is the norm, we do live
day
to day more based off of custom
customary
law.
Yeah.
Like we in that last episode, we talked a lot about the hiking trip we would take and the laws we'd write. In reality, we wouldn't write a law like some sort of code.
No, we just kind of know.
We just know there's customary laws. There's stories of people who hiked before us and problems that they ran into.
Yeah, that's right.
There's just the proverbs, just the wise sayings of like what it means to be a good person. And, and we just know all this stuff. And when something comes up, we're going to appeal to those things.
Correct.
You know, when I wake you up in the morning before it's like the sun came up, you're just going to be like, dude, what's the deal?
Yeah,
like we know
we don't do that around here. That's not a thing you do.
And that's just typically how we live is based off of customary law.
Yeah, and then when a custom is violated, you need to make it explicit. This is why the list of rules at like public pools is so long. You
right.
know,
right?
No running, no jumping, no peeing, no all that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But the only
remember these are all things that we could all agree on.
Totally. Yeah. That's right. But apparently, some things were unspoken, and then we realized, you know, you shouldn't whatever do this in the pool. And so now we have to write the long list.
Yeah. And then it's funny where, like, you get the signs that used to just say no skateboarding, and now it's no skateboarding, no rollerblading, no scooters.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. The custom behind that is like, you know, this is just for pedestrians.
Yes, and, that's right.
Like, let's not like destroy this
property. Did you hear about the sign that our friend Ken put on the pool at his house?
Yeah, I don't remember.
It says, welcome to our ool. There's no P in it.
Yeah.
And let's keep it that way.
Yeah, let's keep it that way.
That's good. Yeah. I like it. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
It's very memorable.
It's memorable.
Like a fairy tale. It's memorable.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is helpful. We're still on the first perspective. It's the longest one.
Yeah.
But it rounds off. It's an inclusio with the last one.
Yeah.
This is the way that the Torah came to be talked about in later Judaism as wisdom, wisdom literature. When you get to the book of Proverbs, the Torah that is passed down from parents to children is equivalent with wisdom.
Mm.
The Torah, first five books of the Bible, are wisdom literature.
And it makes a lot of sense then, too, how the Apostle Paul uses it with like the muzzling the ox.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we'll get to that at the end. But this is the groundwork of a paradigm for approaching the whole Pentateuch, not just the laws, but the whole Pentateuch as a kind of legal education.
Volksgeist.
Yeah, Volksgeist. Legal isn't the right word. Law isn't the right word anymore.
Yeah.
It's
wisdom.
Yes, wisdom. Yeah. Wisdom and the fear of the Lord, living in a way that corresponds to God's will. Mm. And the point isn't to do what these characters do, necessarily, because they do a lot of horrible things. But watching the characters do horrible things is an education for me.
Okay, this is super helpful. And I feel like it could take an entire video just to
do that.
Make this shift.
Yeah.
From there, it feels pretty satisfying.
Like we could just be done talking now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously there's a lot more to talk about, but I mean, man, that's its own treatment.
Yeah, totally. Here, let's just so, can I take one more step? I know we're already well into this conversation. We can do this quickly.
Okay.
Do you remember those problems that scholars noted about the Code of Hammurabi that even though it was copied and everybody read
it. No one.
People didn't quote from it or adhere to it.
Yeah.
The same problem exists with the laws in the Pentateuch within the Old Testament.
Hmm.
First of all, there are different statements about what kind of judges should be appointed in ancient Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Here's two. One's in Exodus 18. One's in Deuteronomy chapter 1. What are the type of people who are to be promoted as judges? Exodus 18. Select out of all the people men who fear God.
Mm-hmm.
They're men of truth,
mm-hmm.
hate dishonest gain.
Mm-hmm.
Do you fear God? You have integrity and you won't take dirty money?
Mm.
Deal. You'll be a judge.
Great.
So notice nothing about an expert in the laws of the Torah.
Oh, sure.
It's just someone's personal character.
Oh, interesting.
Is what qualifies them to be a judge.
Mm.
Deuteronomy 1. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise, experienced men, appointed them as heads over you. I charged your judges. And what qualifies them? Last statement there. Don't show partiality. You'll hear the small and great alike. You don't fear humans, for justice belongs to God.
Hmm.
You can just see it here.
Hmm.
There's nothing about legal education, consulting written texts.
Mm-hmm. And that could either be because it's taking that for granted.
Could be. That's right. It could be. Yeah. But it's just, at least it's noteworthy.
Yep.
Here's another thing. There are narratives, this is on page 13 and following, there are all these narratives where, about actual like legal court scenes
mm-hmm.
in the Old Testament, and the decisions being made are either different from the laws in the Torah or contradict the laws of the Torah.
Hmm.
For example, in 2 Samuel chapter 14, after one of his sons, Absalom, has murdered his other son, Amnon, he's brought before the king, and David just excuses Absalom,
yeah.
contradicting every single law about manslaughter and murder in the Torah. He doesn't even appeal to,
yeah.
I'm the king, here's the law, my son's excused. You're just like, oh, that's interesting.
So maybe he's just not following the Torah.
It could be that he's not following the Torah, but he's the king. Like, nope, there's no... Nobody gets in his face about it.
Yeah.
There's no judges around going, no, what's written in the law?
Yeah.
Okay. Apparently, at this time in Israel's yeah. history, the king's word is the law.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's interesting. Kind of like the Code of Hammurabi, where the gods appointed me.
Yeah.
And I determine. The most detailed trial scene in the whole Old Testament is in the book of Jeremiah,
okay.
where Jeremiah is being tried before the leaders of Israel for announcing that the temple's going to be destroyed.
Mm.
And his defense, he doesn't appeal to or quote from the Torah at all.
Mm-hmm.
What he quotes from is a story about another prophet, Micah,
mm-hmm.
who had the same message, and he never got imprisoned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's arguing not from a law, but from precedent.
Which is, we do that too. It's case law.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And then the arguments against him by the other attorneys, they never quote from the Torah. They just say, he's speaking in the name of Yahweh. That the Yahweh's temple is going to be destroyed. They have a political accusation that he's prophesying against our city.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most detailed court scene in yeah. the whole Old Testament, and yeah. never once are the laws of the Torah pulled out or consulted mm-hmm. or quoted. You just yeah. have to go like, wow, that's really interesting.
Okay.
And so when judges are praised, like Solomon, the famous decision he makes about the two ladies.
Yeah, it's splitting the baby.
Who are both claim the same baby as their son.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes up with a clever solution to get one to tell the truth. And then the quote at the end of that story is, when all Israel heard the judgment which the king decided, they revered the king because they saw in him the wisdom of God to do justice.
Mm-hmm.
So again... they saw that he consulted the Torah.
Yeah,
and
that's not what it says.
No, it's he got an education in the Torah that trained him to become wise.
Yeah.
To know how to make the right decision in this specific situation. So the Torah and its laws were a part of a much larger set of educational tools
yeah.
in Israelite culture.
Wow.
It was a common law society. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was so
helpful.
These
are all
for
examples
me.
Of common law in
Correct.
Practice.
That's right.
Hmm.
Yeah. So this isn't just arguing from similarity with the Code of Hammurabi. This is within the Old Testament itself.
Yeah. What do you see actually
when you yeah.
in practice? It's
yeah.
common law.
It's a common law society. There you go. That was a long
Yeah.
It was a long conversation, but it was a paradigm shift that's been immensely helpful for me in understanding what the Torah is and the laws within it.
It is helpful, and it is a paradigm shift, and it reminds me again of how cross-cultural of an endeavor it is to read the Bible.
Yeah, totally.
Because we have these, we just have these very firm paradigms of what is law, and how does a culture act in respect to law.
Yeah.
And for me, it's just like a no-brainer.
Yeah. It's law codes.
Law code.
Yeah.
And you go to it. What does it say?
Yeah. That's the law.
That's the law.
Yeah.
And if the Bible's not doing that, then the Bible has a problem. And I'm either going to just ignore it or be ashamed of it.
Yeah.
But we are travelers to another time and place when we read the Bible, and we have to we have to unwrap these paradigms, and that's a big one. Mm-hmm. That's a really big one.
Yeah,
that could use its own treatment.
Yeah, I see.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can do it in 60 seconds. Maybe we can do it in 60 seconds.
Yeah, John, you're good at explaining complex things in a short amount of time. you're a deer in the headlights right now. So this took me a few months to really process and sort through. So I was reading. So you're doing this in like an hour. I bet we can. That little visual.
Yeah.
Listeners, visual, can't. But the visual that Michael Lefebvre came up with in his book.
Yeah, we'll put in the show notes.
But it's pretty helpful. Yeah. It just makes it really clear. That the source of obligation isn't to a written text.
Yeah.
It's to a transcendent set of values, of which the written law code is one expression, but so also can narratives and poetry and proverbs and so on. Yep. There you go. I bet we can do that.
Yeah.
I bet we can do that.
Yeah.
The rest of the things, perspectives I want to work through will take much less time. But that is the biggest one.
Okay.
And I think it would be cool to capture that in a minute to 3 minutes. We could do it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Bible Project podcast. Our video on the law is out. It's part of the How to Read the Bible series. You can find it on our website, thebibleproject.com, or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thebibleproject. Today's show is edited and produced by Dan Gummel. We're a nonprofit in Portland, Oregon. You can find everything we're up to at thebibleproject.com.
Hi, this is Mateusz from Poland. I'm excited to be a part of making the Bible Project videos available in Polish. Thank you for your support and let all your friends know these videos are available. We believe the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus. The Bible Project is crowdfunded and you can find free videos, study notes, podcasts and more at thebibleproject.com. Cześć, nazywam się Mateusz, a mieszkam w Polsce. Cieszę się, że mogę uczestniczyć w tworzeniu filmów The Bible Project w języku polskim. Dziękujemy za Twoje wsparcie. Przekaż wszystkim swoim znajomym, że te filmy są już dostępne. Wierzymy, że Biblia jest spójną historią, która prowadzi do Jezusa. The Bible Project jest finansowany przez wielu z Was. Możesz skorzystać z darmowych filmów, notatek do studiowania, podcastów i wielu innych na stronie thebibleproject.com.